You're listening to a Rhino.com podcast. Yes, you are.
Hello, hello, Buttercup. It's your old friend Far Out Marvin, back with another edition of the Rhino Cast. I tell you, it does not get any better than this. So how about we start this soiree moving? First up, an interview with producer and Memphis legend Jim Dickinson. Jim Dickinson is the type of unique individual that the music industry couldn't survive without. The Memphis native is simply a living legend, both as a session musician behind artists like Aretha Franklin, The Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, Ry Cooder, and as a producer for Big Star, The Replacements, Mudhoney, and many others. On the occasion of this, his third solo album, Jungle Jim and the Voodoo Tiger, Rhino.com contributing editor E.C. Gladstone got the rare chance to sit down with the Philosopher King in person during a Memphis recording session.
All right, Jim, it is a pleasure to be speaking to you.
My pleasure to speak.
As always. What do you think people expect when they ask you to perform or produce a record? Perform on or produce a record, I should say.
Well, they usually got some frame of reference, you know, like there's one of my records that they care for or that means something to them. Mm-hmm. And I try to figure that out beforehand because, you know, I could be a tremendous disappointment. you know, my reputation is one thing and I'm kind of something else. Back in, you know, I went to drama school. It was my preparation for this ridiculous career. And at Baylor University in 1960, it was quite a school at the time. And, mm-hmm. They all got thrown off campus the year after I got thrown out. So, but it was at the time it was a world-class theater unit, and we had one of our rooms was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. It was really something. Mm. The guy who ran the place, name was Paul Baker. He's still alive. He's 90 something. Too mean to die. And he said that all performers had a phantom entity that existed outside them that was a result of your performance that you left behind, and the press, and public expectations, and that there was this phantom figure. And in my case, he's far more successful than I am. And the more I can let him do, the better off I am. Uh-huh. And, you know, the fewer people expect to see me jump down and chew the legs off the table, or whatever it is they expect.
Right.
But generally, they have an idea, especially as a sideman, of something they want me to do. Yeah. And like, I'm kind of hard to get in touch with. Mm. And I think that eliminates some of the people who might be confused, you know, who might not really want it. And several times when it seems like semi-inappropriate to me, my participation, I'll you know, talk to artists and A&R and everybody involved and say, make sure you want it, you know, because if I put it on them, it ain't going to come off, you know. Uh-huh. So that's a good question.
It's just an interesting...
A lot of people will come to me because of Ardent, you know, so that's kind of where I draw the line. If what they want is me and Ardent, then of course I have to go to Ardent with them.
Right.
Because you know, and Big Star Third is still what brings them in.
Interesting.
9 times out of 10.
Wow.
A record that barely existed.
Right.
But that's the one that brings them in, which had as much to do with several other people as it did me.
Interesting.
But thank God I got the credit. There's an arranger named Carl Marsh in Nashville who did all the strings and the woodwinds. Mm-hmm. No one ever speaks of him, and he did a brilliant job on that record.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. And of course, John Fry, the engineering is immaculate. It still sounds like it was done yesterday.
Yeah.
And that I had nothing to do with that at all, you know, but I'll be glad to take the credit.
Well, it's interesting how in the music business, reputations can sort of build upon themselves.
Oh, yeah. And to an extent, you know, it's beneficial because, you know, I have a manager, I have representation, but there's, as an independent producer, I can be, it's real easy for them to the company, the artist management, everyone involved to squeeze me like a pimple. You know, I mean, it's my fault. That's one of the things that you have to accept as a producer is the responsibility.
Right.
You know? So it helps to have a little reputation. If they're a little bit afraid of you, there's nothing wrong with that.
it's funny because you impress me as someone who kind of likes, enjoys building up your enigma and knocking it down at the same time.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can always get a little something out of it creatively. Uh-huh. I'm still in it for the project. You know? Uh-huh. I mean, and any producer worth his salt has got to be willing to make a complete and utter fool of himself uh-huh. in order to get a take. Uh-huh. I mean, I've watched Tom Dowd, who was literally a rocket scientist. I mean, literally, you know.
That's right, yeah. Columbia University, right?
Yeah, he was in the Manhattan Project. I mean, yeah. He was in the Atomic Energy Commission when he was 19.
It's amazing, yeah.
But I've seen him literally make a fool of himself to get the cut.
Uh-huh. Because
that's what it's about.
Yeah. What is it about, and this is going to sound like one of these corny English journalist questions, but what is it about the character of Memphis do you think that produces the music and the creativity? There's a certain character of the place, and there's a real character of the people here.
You get a lot of different answers from different people. I've thought about this specific thing way too much. Mm-hmm. Because until I left here, well, both times, when I left and went to college in Texas,
right,
I had no idea that it wasn't like this everywhere.
Wow.
For music and musicians. And all of a sudden, I figured music was over for me when I graduated from high school. Huh. And I went to Texas and I realized, first people I met were musicians, and I realized I had all this arcane knowledge that they didn't have.
Right.
Simply from listening to the damn radio in Memphis and being around this whatever it is here.
Yeah.
And so I fell right back into music as soon as I got to Texas. And the second time I tried to leave town with the Dixie Flyers to work for Atlantic in Miami, it never crossed my mind there was something here geographic that I needed.
Yeah.
When I get away from here, I start to play really funny.
Interesting.
And it creeps into my left hand first. And over the years, I developed a way of playing in Los Angeles, but it's quite different. And I discovered it by Spooner Oldham, the great keyboardist, far better player than I am, and much more sensitive human being than I am. And I had all these different recordings, and seriously, it was Spooner. Mm-hmm. And they were all different from different locales, Memphis, Muscle Shoals, Nashville, LA, wherever, Miami. They were all different, and by far the best came from Memphis.
Wow.
And when I discovered that with Spooner, I thought, oh, wait a minute, I wonder if that's true of me.
Yeah.
Is that what happened to me in Miami? I didn't really lose my mind. I just lost my ability to do what I do in Memphis. And I checked my own old masters, and there it was, the same undeniable thing. And I think what it is about Memphis, the Knox Phillips will tell you it's in the water, the air, all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. See, I think it's a wandering spirit. Mm. And I think it's always here to a certain extent, but it comes and goes like with a vengeance. Sometimes it's really here.
Yeah. You know?
Because I've felt three or four peaks in Memphis music, mm-hmm. and it's amazing. And no one ever knows what's going on but us.
Right.
And, you know, until recently with all this organization and political hoopla that's going on about Memphis music, as they've discovered that it's a tourist attraction.
Right.
God help us. It was always just a bunch of misfits in the dark in the middle of the night in a little room. That's
right.
What it was,
right.
You know, when it was great. But it happens to everybody who comes here. And I think I'm not a great live musician. I just, I don't feel the audience. I feel the audience now. You know, here, I feel my audience in the studio. Yeah. Uh-huh. On stage, I have kind of a mild contempt for the audience, which I realize is unhealthy, so I don't encourage it. You know?
But, I know what you're talking about.
When I'm on stage, I'm on stage for the other musicians, basically.
Right. Well, I think we can wrap it up with that. Jim, as always, it's a pleasure talking with you, whether on tape or not.
And, thank you.
If it's not too corny to say or daunting, I think you're kind of a cultural treasure in some respects.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I set out to become that.
What you just heard, you should have heard more of. For the complete, unedited interview, visit the RhinoCast homepage at rhino.com.
Isn't it beautiful what music can do? Gets us talking into the wee hours. So let's keep it going with the one and only Bob Lefsetz.
guitar work. When he slams the guitar, you can feel that's Pete Townsend, of course, of the Who fame. His solo album, 1980 album, Empty Glass. Hey, it's Bob Lefsetz on the Weekly Rhino Cast. We did not expect anything from Pete Townsend at this particular point in time. The Who peaked with Quadrophenia. You know, after that, the Who by Numbers are a couple of good tracks on that. You know, Squeezebox is not one of them. On the second side where he sings, you know, How Many Friends Have I Really Got? I think the name of the song, phenomenal track if you know that. You know, then it's hard, and we had Eminence Front. The band kind of faded out. Meanwhile, simultaneous with this, in 72, I believe it was, Pete Townsend put out his first solo record, Who Came First. If you don't have that record, buy that immediately. That's got the first release versions of Let's See Action and Pure and Easy. The CD has demos of The Secret that are better than the real stuff. Oh, and explains, you know, I remember when the album came out, I don't know if it's in the liner notes because it's an extensive booklet and I have a special edition. You know, we heard certain industrial sounds and that's how we came up with the groove for Let's See Action. You know, I've been running from side to side, you know, and Pure and Easy there once was a note. Ultimately, those were the songs from Lifehouse, the stuff that was not ultimately in or before in, of course, Who's Next. There's an album called Lifehouse Elements. It was released for about a nanosecond about 4 years ago, and they have an extended version of Pure and Easy. On the Who box set, Maximum R&B, we have Pure and Easy sung by Roger. It's just not the same because we don't have – Pete's voice isn't as good. You can feel the hurt in Pete's voice. Then Pete teamed up in 1977 with Ronnie Lane of the Faces. Ronnie Lane left the Faces, maybe because Rod Stewart came into his band. It was originally the Small Faces. And got in the band. Ronnie Lane had that one great moment where he and Rod Stewart on the second Faces album with Rod Stewart traded off licks on Maybe I'm Amazed. And when Rod came in, I saw that band live during that tour. Outrageous. But he left and he did this solo album with Pete that really didn't have much of an impact. Sort of half his material and half Pete's. There's a great song, Street in the City. Street in the City. I'm not going to play that today because we'd kind of felt that Pete had lost it. And then he puts out this solo album on Atco. That is the opening track, Rough Boy. Supposedly influenced by the punk movement, etc. He was inspired to do this track. Doesn't really sound like punk. But that's where he's coming from. There was a hit on this record, and I'm only going to play to you this hit to bring you back because this is like my least favorite track or second least favorite track on the whole album. I'm talking, of course, Let My Love Open the Door. Maybe you like that track. I'm not going to argue with it. We just heard it too much on the radio back in 1980. The only song I hate more on the album is Jules and Jim. And Keep on Working is kind of a throwaway. But the rest of the album, I mean, today you can't get an album that's playable from beginning to end. You don't even want to play from beginning to end. At least we had a second side where we give it another chance, you know, to get into the record. Now it's like, God, I got to take this thing off. The second track on the album after Rough Boys was I Am an Animal, and it was so quiet. Touched your heart.
they will rearrange me.
But it gets quiet. It touches your soul. And it's a great point. When we get to the quiet part further in the song, King of the fucking universe! You can feel his anger. He wasn't the best-looking guy in the on the block. Roger got all the attention, but Pete was the thinker. Even quieter, after I Am an Animal came And I Moved. That keyboard part, I don't know if that's synthesized, I mean, if it's programmed the same way Baba O'Reilly, but at the end, all those little keyboard sounds come together and you just want to play the track again. Now, the second side started rocking really hard. Keep on working, Cats in the Cupboard. I'll leave you a little bit of Cats in the Cupboard. Listen to the fury. If only we had Keith Moon to play the drums on that. If you ever saw Keith Moon live, you swear there were two drummers. The guy was doing so much. Listen to the drumming on Quadrophenia. Oh, it'll blow your mind. Now we get to the heart of the album. Why Empty Glass is so good. The title track. The song is really rocking. You think you really can't get into it. But then there are these mellow parts and some of the concepts. He talks about a mirror star. There was a song called Mirror Star by the Fabulous Poodles on CBS. around the same time, a little bit after, if I remember correctly. That's like, you know how they've kind of popularized this on MTV. But really, when you're lip syncing, you have the music up loud, especially on headphones, when you can't even hear yourself singing. You're singing along and in front of the mirror. You think you're cool, and it feels so good. And he's talking about dud TV a decade before Bruce Springsteen says there's 57 channels and there's nothing on. But I'm going to go deeper into the song to get to the part that truly resonates. My life's a mess. You know, you don't get any rapper being on MTV saying, my life's a mess. Chingy saying, my life's a mess. My life was a total mess. I'd broken up with my live-in girlfriend. I was drinking too much alcohol. My parents were in town. They bought me a bottle of Bailey's Irish Cream. You can drink that like a milkshake. And I'd finally moved. I'd stopped living with this woman. I was living in my own apartment. And one night after being out to dinner with my family, I came home, and you're crazed. You can't fall asleep. I was already three sheets to the wind, as they say. And I put on the headphones, and I was listening to this record on vinyl, of course. And then I killed the whole bottle of Bailey's Irish Cream. And when I did what's now referred to as drunk dialing. I dialed an old friend who I'd had a falling out with in college. First, I got his father. And by this time, it was, like 6 or 7 in the morning on the East Coast. I was in Los Angeles already, in Santa Monica. And the guy wouldn't give me his son's number. That was the closest I could get. This is way before the internet and being able to check. He says, what are you doing up at that hour in California? And then eventually I spoke with my friend, which was fully unfulfilling. And I haven't spoken with him since. And I kept listening to this track over and over again.
Just can't work life out. Don't let down moods entrance you. Take the wine and shout.
Okay, don't be down in the dumps. You gotta look at it, you gotta go with the changes, etc. But then listen where the song goes right thereafter. The song just ends on this empty note. They give the optimistic stuff. Earlier in the song when it goes, my life's a mess, then it goes back to rocking. Here they give the optimistic part and it goes, my life's a mess. If you've ever known anybody who's been depressed, you're depressed yourself. It doesn't matter. People say, cheer up, get it together, look at the bright side. You can't look at the bright side. And it's all there right in that song. But two songs before is truly, excuse me, one song before, looking at the track listing, is truly the best song on the record. A little is enough. Now, there's a band on Capitol, local band, and they had a song called Belly of the Whale. They had that exact sound, but Pete's going somewhere totally different. Where is he going? We had that mellow intro. Don't get those little pops. You have to understand, guys, for everybody on TV, the girls are crawling all over. The rest of us, we just want to interact. We just want to be in play. And we see something, we get that instinctive feel. And it's that feeling of love, that feeling of connection that lets us be somebody different from whom we really are and reach out. They say that love often passes in a second. You got to act just that quickly, and you can never catch it up. So I'm hanging on to you as though eternity beckoned. Fuck the rest of my life. Fuck my job. Fuck my car. It's all about you. Common sense and tell me not to try and continue. You always hear those love stories. Oh, she rejected me. She was above my level. But I went after her anyway, and I connected. But I'm after a piece of that diamond in you. I don't want you. I want that essence. So keep an eye open. My spirit ain't broken. Your love is so incredible. Your body's so edible. You give me an overdose of love. Just a little. Just a little. Just give me a little chance. Just a little is enough. It's Pete Townsend singing this song. Not some physical specimen out of GQ. A guy with a big nose who's geeky and gawky, and all he's got is intelligence. What are the what he has on the inside, and you can resonate.
I'm like a connoisseur of champagne cognac. The perfume nearly beats the taste. I eat an oyster and I feel the contact, but more than one would be a waste. Some people want an endless line, that's true. But all I have to have is a little time.
He's going on. He's racing. He's saying, hey, you know, let me play. I can do it. A smile sets me reeling. A kiss feels like stealing. Your love is like heroin. And he did heroin. This addict is mellowing. I can't pretend that I'm tough. Just a little is enough. This song is a fucking masterpiece. And you never heard on the radio? I remember, you know, you're looking for answers. I'm jumping ahead in my romantic life. I'm living with this woman who turned out to be my wife. She rolls over in bed one day. Can this marriage be saved? I thought it was a joke, like out of Good Housekeeping. But she left me. And then you start looking for answers. I actually went to a college function. I hadn't been to a college function ever. It was in the hills above Malibu. That's how I rationalized. I said, you know, maybe I'll meet some people. And it was all boring because what kind of person goes to that anyway? And I was this really good-looking girl. And you get your gumption up because you're having such a fucking terrible time. And I went and I talked to her. She's about 10 years younger than I am. And somehow I say, well, I'm in the music business. I talk about music. And all of a sudden she says what she's listening to, which is Pete Townsend, Rough Mix. And I go, a little is enough. And the two of us sing it together. And it's like, hi, I could repeat the story 14 years later. 9 months later, I went to another college function hoping I would see her. I saw her there. It was like we'd never spoken earlier. I felt like Pete Townsend. Now, this album, Empty Glass, ends on an upper. Gonna get you anyway. I'm gonna play it for you because I'm hoping to get what I'm looking for in life anyway. Till next time, it's Bob Lefsetz on the Rhinocast.
This is John Srubalis for Rhino.com. I'd like to tell you about a release that I've been listening to a lot lately. It's from the Grateful Dead, and it's called Live at the Cow Palace, New Year's Eve, 1976. Mixed from the original 16-track analog master tapes and mastered in HD CD sound, Live at the Cow Palace, a 3-CD set from the band's historic New Year's Eve 1976 show, is the latest of Rhino's official multi-track vault releases. Over 13,000 fans shared a transcendent celebration and peak Grateful Dead experience that renowned KSAN DJ and concert co-host Glenn Lambert described as one of those nights when they're airborne from the start and climbing fast on a jet to the promised land. This legendary show features highlights such as Playing in the Band, Morning Dew, Samson and Delilah, Eyes of the World, and Scarlet Begonias. Grateful Dead. live at the Cow Palace, New Year's Eve, 1976. Get it at rhino.com.
Hi, I'm Marty DeLacy, President and CEO of the Coast Loan Affiliates. I'd like to talk a little bit today about our commitment to our customers. Most companies just stick to the basics, loaning money, assessing collateral, and staying competitive with interest rates. But here at Coast, we like to go the extra mile and really bond with our customers. We want to know everything about you. We believe this will make for a more efficient and lasting relationship. This is why, when you call Coast, we will dispatch one of our trained financial minders directly to your home. This way we can find out crucial data, such as, what side of the bed do you sleep on? How many steps on average do you take from your front door out to your car? And what are your thoughts on unicorns? So much more. It may not make sense now or ever, but we like to look at the big picture. So set an extra plate at the dinner table, because Coast Loan Affiliates is moving in. I'm telling you, I could listen to that all day, babies. But let's change gears for just a minute and listen in as Rhino's own John Sirbalas revisits The Clash.
As far as I can tell, there are currently three good excuses for subjecting ye faithful to a droning audio expose on The Clash. January 2007 will see the debut release from The Good, The Bad, and The Queen, a project that joins Blur's Damon Albarn, The Verve's Simon Tong, Africa 70's Tony Allen, and none other than Paul Simonon, bassist for The Clash, that is. No less exciting, perhaps more, is the upcoming sophomore disc from the bi-coastal Yanks of Chick Chick Chick. That's three exclamation points on their album sleeves. Who might not do what they do were it not for the influence of The Clash? And of course there's the recently released Sony Legacy Clash Box, The Singles, which hopefully landed under a few lucky trees this Christmas season. So let's take a trip down the memory lane paved by four guys, five if you count lineup changes, who've collectively staked a pretty good claim to the title, the greatest rock and roll band in the world. Less than a handful of bands formed the genesis of English punk rock, and The Clash were as ground zero as they came. London clothing boutique owner Malcolm McLaren had witnessed New York City's CBGB stirrings, where the Ramones, Television, and Patti Smith were defining the new downtown underground. After failing to import Television's Richard Hell for a band of his own design, McLaren searched for local talent that would put a musical face to the fledgling scene he saw developing around his novelty shop. As McLaren was rounding out the lineup that would become the Sex Pistols, his associate Bernie Rhodes was watching closely. Some would say it was he who clued in McLaren, and helped construct the parallel birth of the similarly fashioned Clash, who made their stage debut virtually alongside both the Pistols and the Damned. The Clash were committed to a positive, socially relevant message from day one, and a volatile, economically crippled London found its way into songs like White Riot and Career Opportunities. Tales of boredom, alienation, and musical expression rounded out the rapid-fire collection, The Clash, that would be heralded as one of rock's most visceral and relevant statements. Firmly established as punk innovators, The Clash perhaps set out to reach a wider audience. The only compromise, if you can call it that, of their sophomore effort was seeking a bigger sound through the hand of an established producer. Hence, Sandy Pearlman of Blue Oyster Cult fame was hired to record Give 'Em Enough Rope. The record revealed one or two modest studio tricks, while otherwise keeping every kernel of punk rock integrity both musically and lyrically. By the time London Calling hit the racks, it was not uncommon to hear The Clash referred to as the greatest rock and roll band in the world. The new double album won them a level of respect that was, and is, rarely achieved in any genre. They not only nailed their trademark sound with a newfound confidence and pop sensibility, but traveled seemingly effortlessly into reggae and R&B, while broadening their battlefield to include the personal and universal. Their next album, 1980's Sandinista, brought global politics and the sound of the New York streets. The sprawling three-record set's price tag, at the time slightly more than for a single record, marked the band's battle on behalf of their fans. While some critics would argue that the tiresome dub and funk treatments made for only one record's worth of good material, most would concur that when Sandinista is good, it's very good. It's easy to forget that when Combat Rock was finally released in 1982 after much creative and personal struggle, it was critically well received. What most tend to remember is how The Clash made it explicit that they wanted to extend their message beyond the cult audience, thereby selling out. The pop appeal of singles Rock the Casbah and Should I Stay or Should I Go, combined with heavy video rotation for the former and an opening slot on the Who reunion tour, did little to dispel such accusations. A little over a year after the release of Combat Rock, the firing of Mick Jones ended The Clash for all practical purposes. The decision followed an exasperating period of business turmoil and creative and ideological differences. Joe Strummer had taken a nostalgic leaning toward the raw sound of the original Clash, while Jones was increasingly interested in the new dance and hip-hop scene. Subsequent efforts under the banner of The Clash were barely worthy of mention. The Combat Rock era was not the only time in the band's history that seemed to represent a lapse in credibility. A reassessment of the personal histories of the band has been said to reveal some punk rock packaging of the facts, as well as a spotty understanding of their own politics. Mick Jones has been cited for burying a past filled with rock and roll hero worship. To deconstructing journalists, his shift from long-haired, bell-bottomed Mott the Hoople adoration to spike-topped leftist scorn couldn't have been more abrupt. Joe Strummer was known to seriously downplay his privileged education, while bassist Paul Simonon seemed to inject a bit more heartbreak into his childhood than existed. In retrospect, the perceived makeovers have bruised their image more than their pre-Clash infractions against the punk rock party line. The band's politics themselves have also come under repeated fire. The origin of their stance as a political band has been attributed to forces outside themselves, and the nature of their ideology has been deemed ambiguous and often contradictory. While the band members always took an official stance against violence and oppression, it was often minimized as the fashionable one to take, their lyrics, mostly written by Strummer, being said to sensationalize potentially violent situations for emotional impact. But Strummer claims, quote, "We never came to destroy," unquote, and the band's more serious, positive message helped keep punk viable in the eyes of the music press once the novelty of the Sex Pistols had worn off. Strummer also claimed that satirical anthems like Guns on the Roof were left deliberately ambiguous in order to avoid preaching. He seemed to save that for interviews, in which he seemed happy to straightforwardly discuss both his leanings, quote, "I'm in Gandhi's and Luther King's army," unquote, and any inherent misconceptions, quote, "We've got loads of contradictions for you," unquote. And whether or not manager Bernie Rose initially set forth their agenda, one would never know it based on the commitment from which they never truly wavered throughout their career. Their words left many confused, and certainly towards the end, they approached their subject matter with a more poetic detachment. But we must remember that these were young musicians rather than politicians, artists rather than scholars. Ironically, bands that use positive and serious means to skewer the status quo are less easily forgiven when they falter. It was hardly worth the effort to pick apart the logic behind the antics of the Sex Pistols or the Damned, but when The Clash did anything in the name of making a living as a group of musicians, punk stalwarts joined industry cynics in painting them as sellouts. The band caught flack for signing to CBS Records early on, for slickly tailoring Give 'Em Enough Rope to the American market, and most notably for lining their pockets with Combat Rock and the subsequent stadium tour. Toward the end, they must have tired of preaching to the converted. Quote, "It's no use being priests. It's all very well getting heard by cult freaks, but I want to get through to the creep who's filling his head with stuff her on the bed and shove it to her, yeah, yeah, yeah," unquote, claimed a besieged Joe Strummer. The Clash left a legacy for scowling, manifesto-carrying outfits like The Exploited, Crass, and MDC, but these bands would almost forsake the rock in punk rock in favor of a more confrontational onslaught. As for a legacy where politics and musical chops meet, later acts like Public Enemy and Rage Against the Machine would continue the vein of the sonic agenda. The ass-shaking potential of primal rock and roll was never lost on The Clash, as they worked timeless influences into their own adrenaline cocktail. Politics and posturing aside, what's given The Clash such staying power is their music. There were plenty of hard-hitting punk bands with something to say, but few were as fun to listen to as The Clash. Are we doing a good podcast? Give us your feedback. Win valuable prizes.
Hey, give me some of that now. Hey, I love it.
Visit us at www.rhino.com/podcast/survey and tell us how you like the RhinoCast. You'll be entered to win $500 worth of Rhino products of your choice. That's www.rhino.com/podcast/survey.
Whoops!
You've just listened to a Rhino.com podcast. Visit Rhino.com for music, movies, and all kinds of crazy shit.